Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Health Care Committee in the Senate. It's March 14th. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 419. Remind us about this bill, Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 419, carried over from March 9th, brought to you by Senator Beyer and Representative Noth. The bill would establish a hospital rate commission, review hospital charges, and recommend to the Oregon Health Authority whether to approve or disapprove each charge.
Great. And we have Jared Mason, Gere, Felisa Higgins, and Paul McKenna. Please proceed.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Mason Gere representing the Oregon Education Association and our 44,000 educators across the state. You heard from our Vice President John Larson, who was here last week to talk on this bill, and he spoke specifically to a lot of the issues that we see school districts struggling with, and a lot, by extension, a lot of our members, as it pertains to rising healthcare costs and the impact they have on both personal and district and government budgets. Additionally, you've received some written testimony from a couple of our different members that have detailed some of the specific issues they've had with healthcare costs. These are people who have very good health insurance and nonetheless have still seen huge out-of-pocket costs due to procedures they've experienced in hospitals. For example, you have testimony from Scott Wagner, who's a diesel tech instructor out in Pendleton, who is incurring each year, not trying to pay off, but is actually incurring each year $10,000 in costs due to cancer treatments he's been undergoing, which actually is the reason he wasn't able to come down, as he's currently undergoing chemotherapy. Another piece of testimony that was submitted is from a member of ours, Bobby Blue, who's a teacher in the David Douglas School District, who had worked herself out of poverty, who's been saving up, eventually was able to buy a house, achieve a level of savings of about $12,000, and after one knee surgery, saw that obliterated. And after her surgery, had actually seen her personal account go down to $30, period, after having saved $12,000. These are the kind of impacts that we know real people are experiencing due to the rising cost of hospital procedures, and we also know that at this point in time there are record levels of hospital executive compensation, record cash reserves. From our vantage point, there are three givens that we know that Oregonians are struggling mightily with the costs of healthcare that are a result of hospital costs. We know that hospitals are doing exceedingly well, and we know that there is a model out there that has worked elsewhere, both for hospitals specifically in the Maryland model, and then looking at insurance rate review, the PUC. We believe it's time to implement that same model for hospitals and bring down healthcare costs for Oregonians around the state. We urge you to take action on SB 419 this session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director for the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, Local 49. We represent about 65,000 workers in the state, including acute care health systems workers and home care providers, nursing home workers who work in the healthcare industry. We're here in support of Senate Bill 419 and its companion bill on the House side. We feel strongly that hospital costs are the largest portion of our healthcare dollar and should be controlled, especially as we're moving into a scenario with the Affordable Care Act. We also feel like that the legislature has very much focused on the Medicaid, controlling the Medicaid costs in the Medicaid market, which we think we've seen some success around that. However, the commercial market, which many of our members purchase their insurance through, is still continuing to rise and is unaffordable for many Oregonians. There's wide variation amongst hospital costs. There's been many news reports out about that. and there's not significant, there's not that same significant variation and no tie to hospital quality. There's significant markups on hospital services, 300, 400%, 200% for varying procedures throughout the state, and there's no oversight or accountability currently in the system to look at those costs. Jared testified and touched base on some of the issues related to the rising increase in revenue, and we know that the hospital marketplace and the healthcare marketplace does not function like a normal marketplace, and so we actually need to treat it more like a heavily regulated marketplace. Is it's a complete hospitals are a complete necessity in our community, and hospital costs are an important part of that. We believe that setting up an oversight committee with Senate Bill 419, having a public process to review rates, creating some equity in pricing, and could help encourage innovation. Also, the work that Maryland has done to move forward on the Maryland model, I think, shows some of the alignment that could happen between the CCOs and the Hospital Rate Review Commission, where we can see some more global budgeting type initiatives that could be moved forward in our healthcare system. With that, we're urging the committee to support Senate Bill 419, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Please.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Paul McKenna. I'm the research director of SEIU Local 503, which represents about 25,000 state agency and public university employees in Oregon who receive health insurance benefits through the Public Employees Benefits Board. Until recently, I was a PEB board member, and from July 2014 to June 2016, I served as chair of the board. I'm here today speaking on behalf of SEIU Local 503 to express support for SB 419 from the perspective of a longtime PEB board member. According to a recent study, Oregon's rates for inpatient hospitalization are 27% above the average for other states. The study, which was conducted by the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement, compared Oregon's provider rates, utilization, and overall costs with four other states. Oregon's overall unit costs, which includes hospital rates, physician rates, and pharmaceutical prices, were found by this study to be 17% above the average. The study also found that utilization in Oregon was 7% below the average, with inpatient utilization 15% below average. Overall costs, combining unit costs and utilization, were found to be 9% above average. Unit costs are the largest cost driver for PEB's overall 2018 cost trend. According to Mercer, PEB's actuarial consultant, 40% of PEB's projected increase in costs for 2018 is attributable to unit costs. Limiting the increase in PEB's unit costs, specifically provider rates, is therefore critical to helping limit PEB cost increases, as well as cost increases in other publicly funded health programs, including OEB and Medicaid. Limiting these cost increases, in turn, will allow the state to invest in critical public services that otherwise might be on the chopping block. In addressing provider rates and working to bring them under control, PEB can certainly direct its insurance carriers to take a harder line with providers in negotiating rates. However, PEB could definitely use the legislature's assistance in achieving this goal. Setting up a process for hospital rate review as proposed in SB 419 would be an important component of an overall strategy to limit or reduce hospital rates, which is clearly needed in order to limit the overall increase in PEB's costs and healthcare costs for Oregonian in general. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for coming. Are there questions? In talking with the chief sponsor of the bill, Senator Beyer, we may be looking at a possible work group for this to continue on. We know that the state of Washington passed this, but was not able to implement it, and I don't know why. The circumstance may be different from us, but please see us after this public hearing to see where we can go with the bill. Okay? All right, thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 419, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2267. Remind us what bill this is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2267 was previously heard by the committee on February 28th. The bill would exempt ophthalmic sonographers from being required to obtain imaging license from the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. The board authorizes the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging to issue limited or temporary permits for qualifying bone densitometry applicants, declares emergency upon passage. No revenue impact. The bill has a minimal fiscal impact. Both impact statements are on the list.
Okay. Any questions or discussion on this bill? All right. I'm in work session, right? Clerk will...
You need a motion.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2267 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves that House Bill 2267 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Yes.
Senator Knowles.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Excused.
Chair Monahan.
Aye. Motion carries. I will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2267, and I will open a work session on House Bill, or Senate Bill 754. Remind us what this bill is.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 754 was previously heard by the committee on February 14th. The measure increases the legal age of tobacco and delivery products for sale from 18 to 20 years of 21 years of age. The measure establishes a set of fines for individual businesses that distribute or sell tobacco-related products or inhalant delivery system to persons under 21 years of age. There is a dash 7 amendment on OLIS. We have the revenue and fiscal impact statements posted on OLIS as well. So the committee has necessary paperwork to move the bill if it so desires.
All right. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, move the dash 7 amendments into the Senate Bill 754.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves the dash 7 amendments into Senate Bill 754. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Amendment 7 adopted. And
Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 754 as amended by the dash 7s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 754 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byers?
Yes.
Senator Knowles?
No.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair Monahan?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 754 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 46. Oliver, would you let us know?
No, it's Senate Bill 46 got pulled.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senate Bill 46 got pulled. I will close the public hearing on 46. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 50. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 50, brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The measure requires additional licensed healthcare professionals and certified alcohol drug counselors to complete the pain management education program every 4 years. The measure adds the following licensed professionals requiring the training requirement in Oregon for this new pain management education: pharmacy technician, optometrist, clinical social worker, professional counselor, marriage and family therapist, marriage therapist, expanded practice dental hygienist, and speech language pathologist to the list. There's no fiscal revenue statements and testimonies on all lists.
Okay, Jim Rickards, is it Denise Teray and Nora Stern? I believe I'm saying those names right. I'm not sure.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. First, I'd like to provide a bit of background on the Oregon Pain Management Commission before moving to the recommended updates to the existing legislation pertaining to the Commission's work. The Oregon Pain Management Commission began as a demonstration project created by Senate Bill 1140 in the 1999 legislative session. Subsequently, the Commission was established in Senate Bill 885 by the legislature in 2001. Its purpose under the legislation is to develop pain management educational programs, recommendations, and curriculum, represent patient concerns to the governor and legislature, and create ways to improve pain management in Oregon through research, policy analysis, and model projects. The commission is also charged with developing a mandatory pain management educational program for healthcare professionals under specified licensing boards. The pain educational program is defined to include the commission's web-based training, Advancing Pain Management in Oregon, and 6 hours of continuing education in pain management, end-of-life care, or a combination of both. The Oregon Pain Management Commission recommends an interdisciplinary approach for optimal treatment of pain. Pain management should be collaborative and address the person's biological, psychological, and social needs. Chronic pain can disrupt a person's family and social relationships, ability to work, and overall well-being. Just as an individual's pain may be caused by many factors, its treatment and management may require a combination of physical, psychological, pharmacological, and social methods that address the whole person. That means providers, including physicians, behavioral health providers, social workers, physical therapists, massage therapists, acupuncturists, and chiropractors need to work together to help individuals address pain. Interdisciplinary care is determined by the individual's needs. It may include treatment for conditions that contribute to pain, including depression, anxiety, and chemical dependency. While interdisciplinary pain management often begins with and is coordinated by the primary care provider, all providers should be able to recognize complex pain so they can address the whole person's complex needs. Inadequate pain treatment, over-reliance on medications for pain management, and lack of knowledge of the biopsychosocial informed care contribute to the serious public health concerns related to opioid medications. Oregon's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program in 2012 reported that 20% of Oregonians live with chronic pain. For too many of them, treatment is focused on prescription drugs, particularly opioids. Public health data that indicates that for 2013, almost one in four Oregonians received prescription for opioid medications. Public health, behavioral health, health systems, academic institutions, policymakers, and law enforcement officials in Oregon are working together statewide and at the local level to reduce the risks associated with the use of opioid medications. Those efforts in particular are concerned with reducing abuse, addictions, and unintentional overdose death. Existing statute requires 10 types of healthcare professionals to complete the Pain Management Commission's online module on pain management. Those include physicians, physician assistants, nurses, nurse practitioners, psychologists, chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, acupuncturists, pharmacists, dentists, physical therapists, and occupational therapists. Effective management of an individual's severe and chronic pain may involve more than one healthcare provider. All professionals responsible for assessing the needs of an individual with acute or chronic pain should all have the same information and confidence to treat safely and effectively. All professionals should share the basic pain education and speak a common pain language. To ensure that all professionals involved in pain management receive ongoing education, the Oregon Pain Management Commission recommends the legislature expand the requirement to complete the online pain management training to additional professionals. The commission recommends that ORS 431.590 be amended to add these 9 types of professionals to the pain education requirement. These include pharmacy technicians, expanded practice dental hygienists, optometrists, clinical social workers, professional counselors, marriage and family therapists, massage therapists, speech language pathologists, and certified alcohol and addictions counselors. Optometrists are included because Senate Bill 152 passed the legislature in 2015, extended optometrists' ability to prescribe opioid pain relievers for eye pain. Finally, the commission recommends changing the continuing education requirement from a one-time training to one that is taken every 4 years. The commission is required to update its education program every 2 years. The pain management education program is intended to be included in licensed healthcare professionals' continuing education requirement already in place and as a minimum for those professions without a continuing educational requirement. Requiring healthcare providers to complete the pain education program every 4 years will provide them with updated research and treatment recommendations that will provide their improve their skills at working with other professionals on shared decision-making and involving patients in their own care planning. Opposition to the pain management educational requirement includes criticism stating the online module is rudimentary and too simple. The Oregon Pain Management module is brief and intended to provide basic information so all healthcare providers share one common language and understanding of pain. The additional six-hour requirement is intended to provide a provider with advanced pain management training specific to their professional and clinical interest. In summary, the Commission is asking the legislature to increase the types of healthcare professionals in Oregon who are required to complete the pain management training and to increase the required frequency of this training from a one-time requirement to every 4 years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. The Oregon Health Authority supports Senate Bill 50 and hopes you will as well. Thanks.
Hi. My name is Denise Teray. I am staff and coordinator to the Oregon Pain Management Commission, so I'm here to help assist answering any questions you might have.
Thank you for that great synopsis, and thank you for listening to this bill. My name is Nora Stern. I am a member of the Pain Commission, and I work in the area of pain education, and I'm a rehab therapist, as physical therapist as well. I've been working for 21 years. I'm with Providence Health and Services, I've worked with this population for my entire career. My primary work at this time is around teaching clinicians about how to talk to their patients effectively and appropriately about pain. So that means that I work with primary care case managers, physicians, care managers, PT, OT, speech, nursing, across the board. And my job there is to promote a common understanding so that all clinicians, as was just said, across the continuum of care and across disciplines, can ensure that patients are getting an accurate understanding of pain so we can start to change the way that we treat pain because the patient is actively engaged. And this is consistent with the call to action from the National Pain Strategy and the Institute of Medicine. So there's considerable evidence now that pain education itself improves patient behavior, experience, and decreases healthcare costs. If the patient fundamentally believes, as most do, that their pain is purely a result of something wrong with their body, which is reinforced, unfortunately, and often inadvertently by clinicians, then efforts to help them are often unsuccessful. So a difference in understanding pain can fundamentally change that. So let me give an example of how this might work and where things can go really awry. Take a patient who's worried about a spine surgery that they think might have gone wrong. We'll call him Mark. Mark's begun, after his surgery, to do less and less as his pain becomes greater with more activities that he does. He's depressed with the old way of thinking. We're trained to look for the source of the pain in the body, and so Mark might very well be sent for more x-rays or MRIs. And we know that, for example, 68% of people who are 40 years old who have disc degeneration could be asymptomatic, and 50% of people 60 years old with facet degeneration can be asymptomatic, yet these findings can often lead to another surgery. We also know that when a patient is sent to get radiological testing first, perhaps because the clinician thinks that that finding must be the source of the pain, there's actually an average cost of episode of care of almost $5,000 more if that patient goes for radiological findings than if they go to physical therapy first. When the next surgery is unsuccessful, Mark will likely be put on another high dose of opioids, which becomes escalated and escalated, and down he goes down the slippery slope that we see all around us, and I don't need to explain to you. It's a terrifying and completely avoidable scenario. With a contemporary understanding of pain, that physician might instead reassure the patient that the surgery was successful and that there are many things that could be causing the pain to persist, because the basic new neuroscience regarding the biopsychosocial nature of pain explains that, and the patient can learn to understand that by the way we all speak together. So some simple changes in language can reinforce the notion that pain and harm are not the same thing. And they could identify a clear pattern of fear avoidance in his presentation, and a new conversation falls into place. And the patient would be directed into rehab, maybe into behavioral health, and back to a return to activity, a complete change in the course of this person's life. So the intent of the Pain Management Commission is to have an updated module that we regularly revise, which we are in the process of revising with interactivity and links, so that we can keep our clinicians completely updated. We know that up to $635 billion is spent a year on pain care, so it's important that we do our best job to treat pain effectively. Thus far in our society, we have not done so. Outdated knowledge has been a key factor in this. In my experience teaching pain science to clinicians and patients across the board, I can concur with the assessment of the National Pain Strategy and the Institute of Medicine that all clinical professionals need further work to update our knowledge on pain science and our clinical processes in developing a plan of care. And I understand the objections that were made and were just mentioned, and the intent, again, is for us to provide consistent messaging across the continuum of care. And the notion that the information might be basic is actually ideal, because we want the information to be clearly able to be communicated to patients. And in fact, the opioid crisis is closely linked with the lack of comfort on the part of clinicians in understanding how to direct patients appropriately. So if we want to change the opioid crisis in this state, we have to change the way that we understand pain. And I'd like to add that the OHA very wisely expanded non-pharmacological options for back pain for Medicaid patients within this state. That benefit will be ill-served unless the clinicians treating those patients understand how to modify their treatment based on the patient presentation appropriately. Thank you.
I'm a nurse, and I'm a retired public health nurse. And as a nurse, we aren't required to have CNEs, but as a professional, I would choose the types of education that I wanted. And in my clients, if they had a pain issue, and most of them didn't, I would refer them to their own clinician. So I, of course, when we passed it and we had to take it in order to renew my license, I had to do the online pain management course. I did that. I don't want to say it was a waste. It wasn't pertinent to how I practice. So what I'm concerned is that there may be a whole lot of providers that are listed here that are not going to be dealing with pain as a part of the service that they give to their patient, and was wondering if this was maybe a little overreaching. Comments?
I would say that, first of all, that pain care is everyone's job, and we have the opportunity as clinicians to change the course of a person's life just by the way we speak with them when they begin to develop acute pain. Most clinicians deal with pain at some point with their patients. Many clinicians deal with pain as a large portion of what they do in patient care. For nursing and inpatient, the amount of time that's spent on pain care can be the bulk of a person's shift, from my understanding from working with nurses on this.
Not a public health nurse. I was just speaking as a nurse in a different area.
And in terms of public health and the public, we have a public health crisis right now in both pain and in opioid addiction, with in tremendously escalating overdose deaths and prescription overdose usage, prescription medication usage. So we need to change the culture of how we understand pain among all clinicians. It's a crisis. It's something that affects everyone, and I just can't even think of something that would be more important for all clinicians to gather around.
Thank you. Comments?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to support what you said. I don't disagree that this is a crisis. I've had plenty of conversations with Dr. Hedberg, Dr. Rickards, lots of other people about this, and I'm working with them on a variety of ways to approach this. Just gave a big lecture to a bunch of people about this. I am very concerned about continuing education requirements mandated by the state, because I think they do cast too broad a brush. You're a physician assistant who works in pathology. Probably not going to be running into too many people where you're dealing with pain issues. I guess what I'm saying is you're right. Most of us encounter people, most healthcare professionals encounter people who are dealing with pain issues, and yes, we need to be careful about our language, but having been one of the people who sat through the original required training, I can tell you that it wasn't relevant. I'm a family physician, which means it should have been relevant to my practice, and it wasn't, And most of us sat there and did other work on our computers for 6 hours to meet the requirement because it was not presented in ways that were educational or interesting or engaging or treated us as adult learners, but instead treated us as idiots who didn't know how to take care of our patients. Now, one would hope that any new modules developed under this sort of legislation would not be the same as the criteria. But I really worry about painting with such a broad brush across entire professions mandating specific forms of continuing education. So I heard what you said. I get it. I'm just really dubious about the state saying, you got to do this. And I think there are other ways that we can approach this potentially. But I'm just anxious about it. I don't know if there's even a good answer for that concern, but
can I respond? So this is just the one-hour module, not the other six. What's done for the other six is really up to the different professions. For this one-hour module, I am complete in agreement about the old module, which is why this is being radically revised. And it's, I think it's going to be an excellent educational tool. So it's not the same tool that we used, which is exactly why we want people to redo it.
But I don't see most of the people who actually do the prescribing in the bill. I mean, physicians aren't in this bill, right?
No, physicians are in the bill. Those are, the ones that were listed were the new ones added.
Yeah.
Physicians, the prescribers are definitely in the bill. They've always been part of that.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought, but maybe I'm just not reading. Maybe the part that talks about physicians isn't. Oh, I see this part here. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but regardless.
Okay.
I've made my point. I'm not going to say anymore.
Oh, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, if I may. The module really addresses the biopsychosocial aspects of pain, so it's more than just the biological features that I think arguably probably a lot of physicians focus on. But if you look at the other individuals included in the list of proposed professionals, such as clinical social workers, I think that biopsychosocial approach really gets at all these individuals. So if all the members of the care team have a basic understanding, then we're really going to all be on the same page and talking about pain, and there won't just be the biological approach or the social approach. So I think that's the benefit of including those additional professionals. So.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. Candace Arnold, and then Jen Baker and Courtney Dresser. And Candace, you go first.
Okay. Hi. Sorry, I wrote mine out so it'd be a little easier to read. Hello, my name is Candace Arnold. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to come and testify in support of this bill. In the fall of 2013, my husband and I took our son to the emergency department at Salem Hospital when his mental health challenges became unsafe to himself, as well to the infant and the three-year-old in our home. We came to this as a last resort, being already engaged in traditional outpatient services. We found ourselves desperately in need of help to keep our family safe in our home. He had begun to have suicidal ideations, attempts, and had created plans to harm the other children in our home. The staff in the psychiatric rooms in the emergency department had decided that he needed a higher level of care, subacute placement, and he should stay in the hospital until an opening can occur or until approvals have been given. We were relieved and scared. Until that day, nothing had been more terrifying than to watch my 10-year-old son rage for a time, only to fall apart in tears, not fully understanding why he was there or how this was helping him. It was cold, hard, sterile, and grungy all at the same time. There was an atmosphere of fear, not only from the security guards that stood in the doorway, but also the smell of the blue gloves worn by everyone he was touched by. It was a hard night for me and my son. We waited, fielding calls from our family and friends whom had taken time off of work to help us care for our other children, telling them the truth that we were waiting to hear from the doctor, MAG, nurse, anyone, that what would happen next. Okay, sorry. 24 hours turned into 48. That turned into 72.
Okay, Candace?
Yes?
I think you signed up for the wrong bill.
Okay.
I think you're referring to Senate Bill 816.
Yes. Wait. I'm sorry. I wrote House Bill 3091. I think they're the same thing. Wrong one. Yes?
Yeah. This
okay.
Is, so you just sit back there and...
get to it.
And we'll wait till we get to 816. And and that's the next one. Okay. Sorry about that. I was...
No problem.
I should have caught that a little earlier, but I thought you were going to get to pain, and you haven't yet. Okay. So, Courtney Dresser and...
I'll talk about pain.
Hi. Okay. My name's Courtney Dresser. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. We're here in opposition to Senate Bill 50 as it's currently drafted. OMA and many provider organizations are extremely concerned with the opioid crisis in our state. For the OMA, we've had been working on this issue for several years. We have an internal task force of different providers that are part of our solution makers, looking at different ideas and vetting those concepts. We also had an annual meeting of over 200 plus of members here not too long ago on this issue alone. Our quarterly magazine had a whole issue on this subject and continues to have articles on this issue. We endorsed the state prescribing guidelines that were recently vetted and from the CDC guidelines in March and November. So we are working on this issue. We continue to work on this issue. We know how important the opioid crisis is, and our providers see that firsthand when they see their patients who are addicted. We are working on legislation on the House side to enhance the use of the prescription drug monitoring program. And we know that all of this work that the state and all of these different provider groups are doing is working as we see the numbers start to finally go down on the trend of how many prescriptions we're seeing in OxyContin and Vicodin. So things are changing, and that's good news. There's still lots to be done. With that said, though, we have always been concerned about mandating CME requirements. I think for us, this bill goes a little too far, and we'd like to look at some different language, if possible, with OHA. We continue to do our best to address this issue, but Senate Bill 50 is just not something that we can support at this time.
Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon, also in opposition to Senate Bill 50. I think that Chair Monica Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward did a great job of capturing our concerns. Really, here in Oregon, for nurses and nurse practitioners who go to be relicensed, there's only one continuing education requirement, and it is the pain management CE that we've been discussing here today. So I hear about this issue and this particular CE quite a bit from our members who across the board oppose required continuing education as a condition of licensure. They share concerns that it's not the most effective approach on this particular issue or really any. Nursing is a very broad discipline, and our members practice in nearly every setting in the healthcare industry. So we have long supported the approach that looks at practice hours and encourages nurses and nurse practitioners to be certified in their specialty so that they can secure professional development that is applicable to their practice. So for those nurses and nurse practitioners who would benefit from the pain management CE, ONA has been proud to join our physician colleagues and other members of the community of the public health community in working on the opioid crisis and promoting the practice guidelines and best practices to our members. But we want to make sure that the opportunity is open for other members who it is less applicable to secure the continuing education that best helps their practice. I'll also highlight, and I know that this is not the first time that I've been in front of this committee in opposition to continuing education requirements. We see several each session, and it really becomes very cumbersome, and it would be incredibly cumbersome if we were to adopt all of the continuing education requirements proposed to this body. They all come with very compelling stories and attached to very important issues, and ONA remains dedicated to helping to solve these problems, but hoping to do it in a different approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right, the final speaker is Mark Ritzlev.
Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Mark Retzloff. I'm a massage therapist in Portland. I'm here representing myself in support of SB 50, requiring a pain education module for my profession and some others. I've read this module, and I think it's a really good step forward for the practice of massage in our state. The practice of massage itself is rather innocuous, but I think that the messages that we deliver to our clients can really have long-lasting impacts and important impacts on the scope of their care. Pain is a complex condition, and it requires individualized care, and we're evolving, this field is evolving from single factor causes of pain, like structural changes and posture, towards multifactorial biopsychosocial approaches. And this this module, or this framework, is really unheard of in my field. People, wasn't part of my education. It was really only when I found this kind of stuff beyond my massage school training that I learned about multifactorial causes of pain. So I think this is a really good way to introduce these concepts to my profession. It's a 1 hour requirement, seems very doable for us. So this module, I think, is a really good blueprint for healthy relationships between massage therapists and our clients going forward. So that's all I have.
Great. Questions? All right. Thank you all for coming. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 50 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 816.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 816, again brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The measure would require Oregon hospitals to submit emergency department abstract records to the Oregon Health Authority. The bill authorizes OHA to issue rules to define the type of data as well as a form that abstract records must contain for all patient discharge records. And the bill authorizes OHA to contract with third party to collect and process abstract records submitted to the agency. No impact statements and testimonies on all lists.
Okay, let's start. We're going to have two phone calls, but let's start with Megan. Is it Kohi, John Collins, and is it Jacek, Jack A. Hasia? Yeah. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Chair. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. I am Senior Director, my address is 6011 Northeast Davis Street, Portland, Oregon. I work as Senior Director for Peer and Wellness Services for Cascadia Behavioral Health Care, which is one of the state's largest behavioral health providers, safety net, nonprofit. However, today I'm here as a private citizen, and I just would like to tell you that when I was 19, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and for the last 40 years have been dealing with that personally as well as professionally. And approximately 2 years ago, I was in a behavioral health crisis, and it necessitated me being in the emergency department of a hospital in Portland. And I was awaiting inpatient placement for my condition. And so I was placed in a room where there's no furniture, just the gurney that I was lying on. My clothes were taken from me. I was given, thank you, I was given a pair of paper pajamas. And so for the next day and a half, that is how it was. Occasionally, someone would come in from the inpatient unit or from other parts of the hospital and ask me questions. But basically, I was by myself most of the time. At one point, there was a turkey sandwich, which I was given. But this is a very traumatizing situation to be in. And you know, I was trying to get control of myself and to get out of the crisis I was in, but this really exacerbated things and made my situation more acute than it needed to have been. This bill, I know it has a lot of requirements attached to it. And it, you know, from what I just heard of the testimony for the last bill, there's some reluctance to endorse bills that have a broad sweeping stroke, is my impression. And I could be wrong about that, but that's my impression. The intent that I'm interested in supporting is that psychiatric patients do not languish in the ED, and if the bill doesn't address that specifically, and I realize that, the intent needs to be to improve care for people having a behavioral health crisis. Now, I know House Bill, I believe it's 3090 and 3091, have some impact on this, and I am very interested in those bills as well. But I would ask you to support making the system better for those of us that do suffer. And I think this bill is a start. We need data to know what's going on so we know where to proceed from there. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you so much.
Chair Monis-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. John Collins. I'm the Director of the Office of Health Analytics, which is in the Health Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on Senate Bill 816, which is a bill authorizing the Oregon Health Authority to collect emergency department discharge records. In 2015, Oregon's 60 acute care hospitals treated and released over 1.4 million visits in the emergency department. Of the approximately 350,000 annual inpatient stays in Oregon hospitals, half start in the emergency department. The emergency department is the front door of a hospital. The emergency department is the healthcare setting critical to the formation and evaluation of healthcare policy. And access to comprehensive emergency department discharge data impacts every division within the Oregon Health Authority. The potential uses of such a data set are numerous. With an emergency department data set, Oregon Health Authority could thoroughly assess the extent of non-emergency care being conducted in the emergency departments and emergency department utilization among the uninsured. An emergency department data set would support emerging policy imperatives around serious and persistent mental illness, enabling the Oregon Health Authority to evaluate the psychiatric and behavioral health treatment in the emergency department through analyses of emergency department boarding and observation stays. An emergency department data set would also support the public health division's population health data needs. Significant and growing public health problems such as opioid overdose, motor vehicle crashes, trauma incidents, marijuana-related adverse events, and appropriate chronic disease management would benefit from a complete and comprehensive emergency department discharge data set. An emergency department discharge data set would augment data available through other data sources maintained by the Oregon Health Authority. Data collected through administrative claims, such as the Medicaid data set and the All Payer All Claims databases, are invaluable but can't provide a complete picture of emergency department visits. Notably, Medicaid data is limited to the Medicaid population, and APEC, the All Payer All Claims data set, lacks information on the uninsured. Discharge data would account for every emergency department visit, regardless of payer. Because it would capture every discharge from the emergency department, such a data set would provide the gold standard against which other data sets could be validated. Finally, by adhering to the national standards for state emergency department data sets, Oregon would be able to compare with other states that participate in the state emergency department data sets database collected by the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality. The Oregon Health Authority feels that collecting and reporting emergency department data is of sufficient importance to be addressed in statute. Requiring emergency department data to be reported gives OHA tools to ensure the highest quality, reliability, and completeness of the data. As an example, Oregon law currently requires reporting of hospital discharge data. This bill just expands the content of that data set. Occasionally, however, hospitals have failed to report as required. When this has happened, the Oregon Health Authority has relied upon the statute to gain compliance. This bill also contains other important fixes, the most important of which is defining reporting requirements in administrative rule. This would enable authority to be more responsive to data needs, and this change would also allow hospital representatives and the hospital association to participate in rulemaking to develop data reporting requirements. In 2015, the Hospital Association worked with the legislature to insert a budget note into House Bill 5526, which required the Oregon Health Authority to conduct a study on emergency department psychiatric boarding. That study determined that this is a problem in Oregon, as it is in the rest of the country. The state of Washington was sued for their boarding problem. The Oregon Health Authority would like to avoid a similar situation. This bill would help us do that by allowing us to monitor and analyze the data to identify trends and solutions. We brought this bill to the Hospital Association for feedback in September and again in January, have done due diligence in attempting to work with them on this bill. Voluntary reporting allows Oregon Health Authority no enforcement mechanisms and will not help the state guard against the lawsuit. Thank you for your time and careful consideration of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let's have the next speaker, and then we'll open it up for discussion.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Jack Halchuk, Chairperson Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and committee members. I live at 3029 13th Street Southeast here in Salem. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 816. I'm a retired licensed psychologist and program administrator now providing consultation and training services for both traditional and peer mental health organizations. Like my friend Megan Cowhey here, I'm also a person with lived experience. I've worked in administrative and clinical capacities for mental health organizations and alcoholism and drug abuse treatment programs in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, New Mexico, and Michigan over a 40-plus year career. My work has included the provision of crisis intervention services and evaluations for involuntary commitment, the fiscal and operational management of crisis intervention departments in community mental health programs, and the training and supervision of those providing such services, which often occur in emergency departments. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 816 requiring hospitals to submit emergency department abstract records to the Oregon Health Authority. My interest in this bill is how the boarding of mental health patients in emergency departments is contributing to the detriment of individuals, families, and the mental health provider and payer systems. Much data has been gathered nationally at federal and state levels. To quote from the 2015 Behavioral Health Patient Boarding in the ED report by the International Association for Healthcare Security and Safety, the additional wait in an emergency department before receiving the deemed mental health services coupled with overcrowding can further deteriorate the health of the patient and can lead to life-threatening circumstances. According to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, many factors contribute to inferior health outcomes. Compromised quality of care. Emergency department is a high-stress work environment, and extra demand due to overcrowding can surge the error rates. Quality measures by Institute of Medicine, that is safety, effectiveness, patient-centeredness, efficiency, timeliness, and equity, are all compromised in overcrowded emergency departments due to long waits and diversion of the ambulance away from the hospital closest to the patients. This results in a 5% increase in likeliness for the patient to die as compared to less crowded emergency units. 2006 IOM reports state that the future of emergency care, hospital-based emergency care, at the breaking point due to overcrowded emergency departments. Timely treatment of the patient is a growing issue. It helps prevent patient pain and suffering, along with delays in diagnosis and treatment. Additionally, given our current state's budget shortfall, solutions to emergency department boarding of mental health patients should also require the adoption of evidence-based but lower-cost resources for post-acute treatment. emerging now in states are more affordable and evidence-based peer services with peer crisis, peer crisis respite programs being a prime example. Such recovery-oriented services have been shown to be effective and less expensive, and also have the advantage of being attractive to patients in need, thus helping reduce the problem of treatment elopement, treatment resistance, and general demoralization more commonly experienced by patients in a traditionally structured treatment environment. I'm going to add a couple of things here that was not in my printed thing. I think also, since we would be requiring and wanting to move people more efficiently and effectively out of emergency departments, we would have to have resources and places for them to be referred, which means we would need to come up with more of that. We don't have the money to afford more very costly hospitalization beds, excessive medication, and so it becomes useful to avoid things like putting our citizens' taxes into profit-making CCOs who do not return that, those profits to expanded services or reduced costs, and use it to benefit privately. I've not lived in a state where that's been allowed in the past, and it takes me by surprise that the CCO concept was structured in a way which could allow for that. We also would be able to benefit, as I pointed out, by some of the other less costly recovery-oriented and peer-based services. I did provide attachments. One is a summary of a study report of a crisis respite service in California called The Second Story, which is doing remarkably well. You know, it's meeting with these individuals, being trained by these individuals about the effectiveness of the program, it's just wonderful to see how individuals who quite often will look to elope from emergency services in the middle of a crisis to a program where, in fact, people say, I want to be there. And, yeah, I want to stay here. This is actually comforting. And I'm starting to heal, and they're not forcing me to take medication if I don't absolutely want to, unless, of course, there's safety issues, which would apply. But the nature of our more traditional treatment environments in those cases often move towards more coercive measures. The second handout that I provided as well is a copy of the SAMHSA consensus statement on recovery. And I know that as peers, we've not done a very good job of educating legislators, citizens, about what we're talking about when we use the word recovery. Quite often it gets interpreted as meaning, oh, you're talking about the healing process, recovering process. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a conceptual and philosophical framework that has now, since the President's New Freedom Commission approval in 2003, has been driving transformation in the mental health system. And it refers to humane and dignified methods of dealing with individuals, giving them what is called self-determination, the ability to design for themselves and use what they know to work, and provide that to providers like myself, who then say, well, let me use my expertise, not to tell you what's good for you or the best for you, but to listen to you, tell me what's best for you, and then provide the knowledge I have to offer you options and selections.
Many Hatchak,
states, I'm nearing the end right here.
Okay.
Is that what you're going to get to?
Well, yes, we want to be pertinent to the bill.
Yes, sir. Many states have begun addressing the emergency department boarding problem, and Oregon should proceed to systematically do so now as well. Senate Bill 816 is a good first step toward a proactive solution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. All right. Questions for this panel, and you go ahead and call the next one. All right, no questions. Thank you very much. And we are going to be calling Teresa Dean. Lee.
phone's not working. Let me go get some help.
Okay, well, somehow the phone's not working, so we will call Candace Arnold. Can you give your story briefly, please?
Thank you for letting me come back up.
You bet.
I will just briefly, I won't go over the whole thing again, but where I had left was that...
Say your name. You have to say
your name. My name is Candace Arnold. I'm a family support specialist with Oregon Family Support Network, but I'm here as a mother today. In the fall of 2013, we had taken my son to the emergency department for a mental health crisis. And I think when I finished, he had been in the room for about 3 days. We went over a weekend, so we were at the 3 day mark. We were not the only people feeling the tension. My son had been dysregulated for a time, and being put in that position kind of kept him in a dysregulated state, so he kept dysregulating more and more, and it was really hard for him to stabilize. He didn't know what subacute meant, neither had I at that point, and it caused a cycle of escalation over the next few days. We were receiving messages from the staff that we were waiting to hear back for a placement or on funding, but my husband and I were losing hope that we could get any help. It seemed that we were floundering. On the fourth day, a Monday morning, the mental health examiner came to us to discuss a discharge back home. I was so confused. If he is not safe enough to go home on day one, why is he now safe enough to go home without interventions and no supports? I asked about a million questions in my disbelief, and I advocated to the best of my abilities, but found no results. He was not going to subacute, but rather coming home with a new med that caused him to be so tired he couldn't fight. That was our safety plan. If he was to escalate, we should give him a pill and it should help mellow him out. It's not a good plan, but it's a plan, they said. We spent the next month at home. I had to quit my job to stay home with him. He was unable to go to school for the next 3 weeks or access a higher level of care for another month and a half. Unfortunately, this was not my son's last stay in the ER. Over the next year, he would have two additional trips to the emergency room, P rooms, for a total of 10 days in their care. Three times we came from extreme safety concerns, and only once did a three-day visit end with him actually receiving some sort of movement in the hospital, and that was to a developmental disabilities therapeutic foster home. So not necessarily even an intervention or treatment, but more of an intervention. I now work as a family support specialist with the emergency department diversion pilot program, and I have the blessing to connect with families and support with them on their next steps as they are discharged from the emergency room without services. I have been blessed to find purpose in my pain, but for so many families, this experience will not have such a happy ending. And I believe it'll taint their view of what the supports and the care of great facilities can be.
Thank you very much. And I think that this is what you're providing a situation and why we maybe need to track some of this information.
Yes.
So that we know what we how we can address the,
yeah,
the care of
I believe
those
that seniors. They do great work with OHA, and I believe they can do some great work to find some solutions.
Thank you.
Hello?
Is this Teresa Dean?
Yes, it is.
This is State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. You are on the phone to the committee, and please state your name and give your testimony on Senate Bill 816.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Chair Montes Anderson and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Teresa Dean, and I'm a registered nurse practicing in Medford, and I'm also the mother of four children. And I'm here today to share my experience about one of my sons regarding emergency room boarding. My son, Luca, who just turned 14 years old, experiences autism and Tourette syndrome, In managing his behavior and the anxiety he experiences has always been a challenge, but this past year has by far been the most difficult. You know, as puberty set in, Luca was becoming increasingly agitated and began to exhibit some aggression. Between October and November of last year, Luca had 7 emergency room visits here at Asante Rogue Regional Medical Center in Medford. Most of those visits were treat and release, but one of those visits lasted 7 days. He was held in the psychiatric care unit of the emergency room, and another visit lasted, there was one for 4 days and another for 7 days. And after that 7-day visit, Luca was transferred to one of only 2 child and adolescent behavioral health units in the entire state, Providence, Willamette Falls, and Oregon City. And he spent about 2 weeks there stabilizing. He was discharged to a group home in Salem where he's actually still waiting placement in Medford, so he's pretty far away. And in January, the group home staff actually had to take Luca to the emergency room in Salem at Salem Health for aggression, and he spent another 4 days in the emergency room there. So, you know, as a nurse and as a parent, I've observed a number of issues around emergency room boarding, and I've actually cared for children in the emergency room, same similar situations. If a child can't be discharged home, then where are they supposed to go? And this is a really huge challenge for the social workers in the emergency rooms as they bounce between, you know, pressuring parents to take their child home and searching for a facility that will accept the admission. And usually kids are discharged to the first available opening, not always to what is the most appropriate setting. And so, you know, gathering data on, you know, especially on these issues can begin to look at the discharge practices and how they contribute to readmission rates. Another issue that I've seen is around the mental illness versus a developmental disability diagnosis. They're, you know, when these kids present to emergency rooms, they're treated the same way, you know, typically with medications and many times the same medications. But emergency room staff, even the psychiatric trained staff, are ill-equipped to manage patients with a DD diagnosis. Many times they're nonverbal, and there's a lot of behavior issues that they don't have the experience to deal with. And so I think that, you know, gathering information on that primary diagnosis that's responsible for, you know, for these boarding episodes would be really important to see what the greatest, you know, population implicated in that practice is. And, you know, lastly, one of the other issues that I've seen is staffing and hospital staffing and capacity. When my son went up to Providence Willamette Falls, I visited him and there were only maybe 4 other kids in the entire adolescent unit, and I was blown away. I'm like, why are there kids in emergency rooms all over the state, yet this unit is almost empty? I said, please don't tell me this is a staffing issue, and it was. So I think that tracking capacity versus census could provide some really valuable information. There's very, especially for these kids, there's very limited resources, and they should be utilized appropriately. When my son was in the emergency room at the hospital in Salem, his group home leadership actually had to really advocate for him to stay there. The hospital was basically insisting that he be accepted back or that they evict him from their home. And I think that speaks to the pressure that hospitals feel trying to discharge these children out of the emergency rooms. So in summary, I feel like the, you know, more robust reporting from hospitals will allow to identify trends in this frequent ED utilization for mental health and behavioral health crisis and emergency room boarding. And it'll allow some attention to be placed on identifying gaps in services and provide valuable information, which hopefully in turn can affect policy in a way that will improve, you know, patient care for children like my son and many of the other children that are sitting in emergency rooms all over the state right now. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Dean, so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have one more call to Todd Bybee and Parhi Sather.
Todd's here.
Oh, Todd's here. Yeah. So, okay.
Should I go ahead?
wait for him to answer, and then if he doesn't mind holding on.
Ground Hospital IT, this is Par.
Hi, Par. Par Sattar? Or Sater?
Yes, Sattar.
Sattar, okay. Yes, this is State Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. And could you please state your name, and do you want Todd Bybee to go first? Yeah, Todd will go first, and then we will have you give your testimony, okay?
Certainly.
Okay.
Chair Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Todd Bybee. I'm the manager of payer contracting and government reimbursement for Tuolity Healthcare in Hillsboro, Oregon. And I've been there for 14 years, and I've been in the healthcare industry for 25 years. And I appreciate this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 816. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and Apprise Health Insights. The association represents Oregon's 62 hospitals, health systems, and patients that they serve. Apprise is the data and analytics subsidiary of that association. We oppose Senate Bill 816. Senate Bill 816 would require hospitals to submit emergency data or emergency department data to the Oregon Health Authority. It allows the Oregon Health Authority to define in rule the data elements that would be required and allows the state to charge a fee for that data collection. You can read in the written testimony submitted by Apprise the concerns with the data collection fee and the lessons learned from prior efforts. I'd like to focus my comments on how we've been a collaborative partner when it comes to informing health policy efforts using emergency department data. I'm a member of the association's Data Governance Committee, and we're a charter committee of hospital data experts that review incoming data requests from the Oregon Health Authority and other stakeholders. We discuss how to best respond to those requests from a statewide and quality perspective. I'd like to share two recent examples. First, since Oregon legalized marijuana, we have been informing policy development and evaluation by providing emergency department visit data, counts and trends for marijuana-related acute events by age, sex, payer, and other dimensions as requested. Second, we have been working in collaboration with the OHA to inform the state's behavioral health strategies for the recently released Emergency Department Boarding of Psychiatric Patients Report. OAHHS, the association, provided all the data elements and helped with the analysis. We crosswalked multiple data sets to ensure a complete picture of identified cases of boarding. The complete data and analysis helped inform health policy research and recommendations. In addition, we provided emergency department visit data for uninsured adults with mental health diagnoses to understand trends for that population. Hospitals are very committed to ensuring data quality and look forward to continued conversations about how to make that data available for statewide health policy development and evaluation. Thank you for allowing me to share these comments with you, and I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Let's wait for Mr. Sattar. Please proceed.
Yes, Chair Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, I am Parhiz Sattar, Senior Director of Information Technology at Grand Ronde Hospital in La Grande, Oregon. I have been in healthcare IT management for the last 23 years, all of it in rural Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 816. As with Todd, I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Specifically, I would like to highlight our concerns with this bill from a rural hospital perspective. Rural hospitals already dedicate significant resources to gather and prepare data for submission. Mandatory data collection often falls on the shoulders of clinicians. This takes away from patient care. For emergency department data, rural hospitals work closely with Apprise to ensure compliance with data submission requirements and standards. Apprise provides us support and technical assistance when needed. Finally, all Oregon hospitals voluntarily submit this data at no additional cost to the state. Adding a fee to this process would create additional burden, particularly for small and rural hospitals. Thank you for allowing me to share these concerns with you, and I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Yes, I have some questions for you. I really see the advantage of data regarding those who are mentally ill and are with developmental disabilities. it's a concern of mine on sometimes how long they stay in the hospital, as well as the treatment in a caring and safe environment for them. I know it's safe, but it isn't necessarily caring with some of the situations that I've heard about. So I know this bill is very broad. It's covering all patients discharged during the preceding calendar year. That's hundreds of thousands of encounters. Is there any way to at least provide some of that information? How difficult would it be for you to provide the information, especially regarding those that come in with a mental health crisis?
Chair Mona Anderson and committee, I don't know exactly. It would depend on the data elements being requested. I think the association would need to look into the specifics of a detailed question, but I think that could mm-hmm. be done.
Okay. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much. I've been listening to testimony on both of this issue, and I'm really intrigued by this question. It's pretty clear that not having emergency department discharge data is a pretty big gap. I mean, if we already have inpatient data that we're getting, you know, hospital discharge data that we're getting, and other ones, I guess, and as I think about using data to try to control our healthcare costs and direct people to the right source of care at the right time, I guess I'm trying to figure out why providing this would be so much harder than what you're already doing. That's my first question.
I don't think, but Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for that question, Chair Moniz. I don't think the question is so much how difficult it would be to gather the data. I think the association and the hospitals are willing to be a good partner in helping to share that data. I think it's the mandated or the putting it into rule and requiring certain data elements that might be particularly difficult or new for the hospitals that would be a concern.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I actually had a question for OHA.
Okay.
If they're willing to
Mr.
come
Collins.
Back. I just wanted to listen to all the testimony before I ask this question. I'm a little puzzled as to why, if the hospitals are already providing the other data without a fee, why would there be a fee imposed on them for providing data that you're requiring?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, the Hospital Association collects emergency department data on a voluntary basis from its hospital members. And they initiated that on their own. OHA, under statute, also collects hospital discharge data, which does have a fee associated with it. By mandating this under this particular Senate bill, we would basically be broadening that fee to include the emergency department data collection to basically be consistent with a hospital discharge and allow us to contract with a provider to collect the information and pass it on to us.
Okay.
So it would basically defray the cost associated with that.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. And so this is for both of you now, so thank you for sitting there together. So could you give me some examples of the kinds of data that OHA might require that would be hard for you to get based on what you're already doing?
Well, most of the clinical data that would be gathered by a hospital or by a provider has to be set up in a computer system, has to be a workflow designed to capture that data. If this was some kind of new element that was not currently being captured, there's a lot of effort involved there and system design. But for elements that are already being captured, I think the association has worked with OHA in the past to find a pathway to share that data as a good partner.
So
I'm fine. Thanks,
what I would like then is, obviously there's a conflict here, and it would be nice if the Hospital Association and OHA can look at the data sets and figure out how we could make this bill workable for both the Hospital Association, but still gather the data that OHA would need, which I feel you need. to be able to do some good public health work. Okay. All right. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question that comes to mind, if I'm hearing this correctly, hospitals are already contracting with someone to collect this data and provide it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's
OHA.
Correct.
What OHA wants to do is to contract with somebody to collect this information in the format they need and provide it to them. Is that correct?
Chair Bonasanis and Senator Beyer, yes, that is correct, but also with the authority to enforce the collection rather than it being voluntary. Which right now under the hospital association situation, it is a voluntary collection and there's no way to enforce the complete collection of the information as it currently stands.
Follow up. So if we gave the authority to enforce it and directed you to contract with the hospital association to provide the information, would that meet the need since you're going to contract anyway?
If it's possible, we'd have to go through our normal processes for any kind of contract, but that's definitely a possibility.
Well, if we directed you, you wouldn't have to go through your normal process.
Yes, sir.
Chair Mona's Anderson and Senator Beyer, I don't believe there's been many or any instances of the hospital not providing data in the past. If there have been instances, I believe it's been one-off situations and delays in gathering information, but I don't believe there's been instances where the hospitals have not provided the requested data. So, but we're compliant with the data requests as far as I know.
If I may respond, it's not so much that they are not responsive to our data requests. It's more about the completeness of the data set, including all the data elements that are required. For example, much of the testimony that you heard today was in regards to psychiatric boarding. In order for us to track psychiatric boarding, we have to be able to track the time at which a person enters the emergency department and the time at which they leave, not just the date. In our analysis of the data set that we have been provided by the hospital association, many times those fields are left blank. On the other hand, if you look at the hospital discharge data set, which is also collected and submitted to us through the hospital association, it also has a requirement of including hour and time of admission and discharge. It is nearly 100% complete. So that is basically an example of what we're looking to be able to enforce by having this in statute.
Senator Steinhardt.
Thank you. I've become even more confused. I am a data geek. I mean, anybody who's worked with you will tell you that. I love data sets. I love to use them to understand what we're doing well and what needs to be changed. I am a firm believer that sharing data can help us improve all sorts of things, and in particular in the healthcare universe. But that being said, there are a bunch of other data sets that are already required under state law, such as the State Cancer Registry. And I can tell you, having done research with that registry, that the quality of data and the completeness of data that comes in varies wildly from hospital to hospital. Now, hopefully it's improved in the 10 years or so since I last did data with that data set. But requiring it by law is no guarantee that you're going to improve the quality of the data. So that's my first question or concern. The second piece of it then becomes, I'm not hearing from the hospital association that they're unwilling to work with you or figure out ways to improve the quality of the data that you're getting or the completeness of the data you're getting. Mind you, when I first saw this bill, I was totally on your side on this one, but I'm getting less convinced as I go along because I think I'm hearing from the hospital association, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you guys are more than willing to work in a really proactive, collaborative way. If I'm missing something, tell me, but I'm puzzled.
Chair Monson-Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, the hospital association has offered to work with us. I think the main thing that we keep on coming back to is the voluntary nature of the program that they're running around emergency department data. We want to ensure that we can collect the information from all the hospitals. And while that's by no means a guarantee that the data sets will always be complete, we do know from experience in working with the hospital discharge data set, it does give us some leverage in working back with the hospitals when we have had issues around the completeness of the data. So really, in looking forward to this and incorporating it into statute, we've incorporated several elements which would allow us to explore the data elements in rule, which allows us to work with the hospital association around the actual elements. But I think the main thing that we're standing on is, and concerned about ourselves, is the voluntary nature of the program and their current data collection of the emergency department data.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
I'm a little confused. I don't hear you saying that hospitals are ever objecting to providing the data. I do hear you say that sometimes the data that you've gotten isn't complete, but that could be a communications problem. And I'm hearing the hospitals say they're more than willing to give you the data they need. So I'm a little confused on that. It's, in my experience, it's always better if you have a cooperative relationship as opposed to a mandated one.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Beyer, the other way to look at this is that currently we have a mandated situation around our hospital discharge data set, and we have worked cooperatively with this, with the hospital association around that particular data set. And I believe having it in statute has facilitated that. What we're looking to do here under this particular Senate bill is to be inclusive of the emergency department data along with the inpatient hospital discharge data set so that we have a complete set of information. And having one within statute and the other outside of statute doesn't give us the same leverages for both sets.
Well, what I really would, I'm very interested in psychiatric boarding from the hospitals and complete information on that. I truly am. What I'd like is, since we now know where everyone stands, is for the hospital association and OHA to get together to see if you can come up with something that would be workable for both of you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I appreciate your emphasizing psychiatric care and psychiatric care. I agree that's important. But honestly, if you're going to do this, it should be everything. Because I think we need to know about who's going to hospital emergency departments for things that could be better cared for in other settings. And how do we make sure that there are the widest range of settings available where people can get care and use the healthcare transformation that we're doing? So it's at your discretion, of course, Madam Chair, but I would love to see it all.
I think this is, I'm not sure how many, if it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of encounters that you have to go through, how easy it would be. I mean, to me, of course, all of the information would be good, and I think it would be better taken care of offline than come back to me to let me know how it's going, all right? So we know what to do with this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to close. That's correct, right? Yeah, close the public hearing on 816. I'm going to jump to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 856.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856 would allow naturopathic physicians to perform a number of activities medical doctors are currently authorized and licensed to perform in Oregon. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment on all this.
Okay, Phil Donovan, Dr. Regina, is it Dahan? Dahan and Laura Farr. And $127-page bill.
Hey.
Or at least the amendments.
We're going to break it down.
At least the amendments, 127 pages.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Just quickly for the record, a little history. The original bill was drafted, it was 94 pages. That was drafted last October. We attempted outreach to state agencies, affected stakeholders that we could think of. And turns out they've got full-time jobs, and it literally took months to get feedback from all these different entities, all the different sections. But nevertheless, DHS, Office of Rural Health, OHSU, ONA, OTLA, Planned Parenthood, Right to Life, Compassionate Oregon, Oregon Speech Language Health, Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association, expanded practice dental hygiene. The list goes on. A lot of people got back to us, gave us improvements. To be clear, not everybody we reached out to got back to us, but eventually I had to say, we got to take this into LC and get a dash one amended drafted. And when I took it into them, they said, this is pretty big, and we're not going to get this done before the drop deadline. So with that, I just want to put on the record, disregard the original bill. We've got the dash one amendment that was shared with your offices last week. We then developed an annotated overview, which was shared with each of your offices so that you have a handy cheat sheet to just know what the different sections are without having to go through all 127 pages.
And believe me, that is very helpful.
Thank you. So with me, Laura Farr, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, Dr. Regina Dehan, Chief Medical Officer and Dean of Clinics at the National University of Natural Medicine. They're going to give you a couple real-world examples of what's in that legislation and why this will help move healthcare forward in Oregon. Thank you.
Shall I start?
I'll start. Okay. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for your attention today. My name is Laura Farr. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. This committee is very familiar with naturopathic providers already, and I appreciate and value that. You know that we are licensed as primary care physicians. We're recognized by Medicaid, CCOs, most private insurers as primary care physicians. We have a scope of practice that allows us to act as such. Our scope has evolved a lot over the last 10 to 15 years or so. Unfortunately, a lot of statutes have not evolved at the same pace that our scope has evolved. So that is what Senate Bill 856 looks to fix. I would bring your attention to the summary at the top of the page of the bill. And the summary, I think, ironically, is one of the best examples of why this bill is necessary. The summary says, allows naturopathic physicians to perform certain actions that physicians are authorized to perform. Now, right out of the bat, you can see that that is fairly vague. Now, the word physician is not owned by any specific provider type. The titles of medical doctor, naturopathic doctor, doctor of osteopathy, doctor of chiropractic, doctor of podiatry, all have legal authority to use the term physician in our titles. So when the term physician is used, like it is in the summary, in a generic way, one of three things can happen. The term physician is applied universally to all of those different provider types that I just outlined. So in this case, the summary could be inferred to mean allows naturopathic physicians to perform certain actions that a medical, osteopathic, podiatric, and chiropractic or naturopathic physician can perform. I don't think that was the intent of the author who drafted the summary. The other more common interpretation of the term physician is very narrowly to mean an MDDO, usually licensed as under Chapter 677 of statute. Or even more commonly, what happens is when the term physician is used generically, it is interpreted differently by different entities. And that becomes really fun when you're talking about patient care, when you have different agencies who are interpreting what is or who is a physician in different ways. So in certain places in statute, the term is very ambiguous. What is a physician? In other places in statute, the term is very specifically defined, usually as just an MD-DO, even when it applies to things that are very clearly in the scope of practice of a naturopathic doctor. Sometimes the term provider is used, sometimes the term a medical board is used, but again, it leaves it open to something that's in the scope of a naturopathic provider is narrowly defined that only an MD or DO can do that particular service. So let me give some examples in particular. This bill is about removing barriers to patient access to care. I had somebody come to me just a couple of days ago and said they went to their naturopathic doctor who they see for primary care to complete their pulsed form. It's a relatively simple thing to do. A naturopathic doctor is not allowed to sign off on a pulsed form because in statute it specifically says only an MD-DO as defined by Chapter 677 may sign off on the pulsed forms. So what did that person do? They didn't get it done. They weren't going to go to another provider. They weren't going to take the time, go through the hassle of finding another MD who doesn't know their medical history, and they certainly weren't going to go through the extra cost of an additional visit to the doctor, which could cost upwards of $180 to $250 for a new visit. So that's just one example. I'll draw your attention to, in the materials that I provided you written, to an email from a special education teacher in the Portland Public School District. She's frustrated because the Department of Education has interpreted the statute that says a medical exam for special education services must be signed by a physician licensed by a state board of medical examiners. Clearly, the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine is a state board of medical examiners. However, the Department of Education has interpreted that a state board of medical examiners means the Oregon Medical Board, which means that only MDs and DOs can sign off on medical exams for special education plans. Again, you know, short story, I had a patient advocate who was representing a single mother in a rural community in Oregon who ran into this problem with their school district, not recognizing the medical exam form written by the naturopathic doctor. She could not take time off work to go travel the time that she needed to travel to find a medical doctor to sign off on this form. They were pulling their hair out. They didn't know how to get the services that they needed for the child. You'll see that the statutes range in the three-page summary that I provided for you, everywhere from extending liability coverage for using automated defibrillators, for example. Senator Steiner Hayward here would be protected for helping somebody in an emergency situation if that outcome turned poorly. However, a naturopathic doctor would not be. In fact, Senator Montes Anderson, you wouldn't be either. RNs are not included in the liability protections. It ranges to performing medical exams for developmental disabilities or mental health patients, providing services in the foster care system, as well as the prison system, all points in between. I also want to point out, this is the last thing, that many of these changes create opportunities for different organizations to hire or use the services of NDs. It does not create a requirement to do so. For example, adding naturopathic doctors to the list of providers that a correctional facility can use for reviewing medical plans or dietary needs does not mean that a prison has to hire a naturopathic doctor to do that. It just creates the opportunity for them to access another kind of provider type for those services. We did approach this technical fix bill as one large omnibus bill, obviously. We are really hoping to clarify all of these ambiguous places in statute in one fell swoop, rather than coming back at you year after year for 110 years to address each of these individually. So I do welcome any questions, and I also will turn it over to Dr. Dean, who represents the
university. Go ahead and provide your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Good afternoon, Chair Montes Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Regina Dean. As stated earlier, I am a naturopathic physician. I've been in practice for 20 years. I am the chief medical officer at the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland and its clinics in Portland. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 856, and I strongly urge you to adopt the amendments being considered for many reasons, including the following. First, and I think most importantly, there is a greater demand than ever for an expanded healthcare workforce and for every member of that workforce to be working at the highest level of their scope. This bill would allow naturopaths to do that. We have been at the Naturopathic University, a patient-centered primary care home since 2015. This year is our biennial year for RIA testing. We tested at the time as a tier three. This year we're shooting for five-star recognition. We believe we can hit that measure, and that's been a fabulous opportunity for naturopaths to demonstrate the quality of the care that they can provide with respect to primary care services throughout the state. That is more important in, as I heard spoken, this more aggressive federal administration than ever. When demonstrating that the triple aim was a reality, that it is possible to provide expanded care for more people at lower costs, and naturopaths can help contribute to the achievement of that and demonstration of its validity. We'd like to continue to be able to support the state in its ability to provide that information. The current omission of naturopaths in the definition of physician in statute creates barriers to care for patients in unexpected ways. An example is the inability to refer patients for convalescent care when they're discharged from the hospital. As their primary care providers and as the clinic is identified in Epic, we have notification from the database when our patients are discharged from care. But when those patients need convalescent care or at-home health nursing services, we cannot sign the orders for that. It creates a barrier to care for those patients when they are at some of their most vulnerable times. Likewise, describing vulnerability with respect to confidentiality for minors. Naturopaths, at this point, it's ambiguous in the law whether or not we can maintain confidentiality for minors who are seeking our care for contraceptive services or for care for substance abuse. And it's unclear whether or not we have to report it to their parents, if we can report it to their parents, or we are allowed to maintain confidentiality. That is an awful barrier to care and has long-standing expensive consequences. Another obstacle was the ability to provide those physician orders for life-sustaining therapy. Since we cannot sign that nor an advance directive, a patient who's been assigned to us for primary care services, who finds themselves at end-of-life care in hospice, who does not require or desire resuscitation, would end up experiencing that if emergency services were called as a result of their coding or having a heart attack. They would end up actually being resuscitated when they would not want to be. Again, most vulnerable populations, expenses that are unnecessary, and barriers to care. I think it merits highlighting that Senate Bill 856 is not a scope expansion bill in any way. Naturopathic physicians already have a complete primary care scope of practice. It clarifies the terms in the law and clarifies that the same authorities, access, responsibilities, and liability protections extend to all providers equally. In summary, failure to support this bill has negative impacts on patient care, reducing the effective workforce, reducing quality of care, and increasing costs unnecessarily. Again, for all of the patients who choose to see a naturopathic physician for their primary care, I urge you to please support Senate Bill 856 and the amendments as offered today by the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Comments? Okay, I do plan to read the whole, all of the amendments, and I love it that you, in red highlighted, describing what the changes really were, and then I'd like to have a conversation with you, and we also need to hear from OMA and to see what their concerns are, but would like to speak with you after this.
We will schedule that, Madam Chair, and I'll identify that even in the work of our review of the dash ones, we found a couple of question marks. So looking forward to continuing work. We'll probably hope to bring a dash two to the committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
And yes. And then I will share what I find with you when I have questions. If I have questions, you probably will have questions too. So I'll clarify that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Courtney Dresser.
For the record, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and the senator just gave my testimony. So I think we're just doing one final review of the very long amendment ourselves, and then we'll be reaching out to the proponents and to the chair if we have any red flags. So
that'd be great. Thank you very much. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 856. And 861, how long is it going to take you?
Not very.
Okay. Would you prefer if I carry it over?
Yeah.
Will you be here on Thursday?
Let me just check.
I can't. I got a boogie.
It's important to me you will be.
I know. Okay. Oliver, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 861. And I didn't open a public hearing, did I? Okay. And with that, we're adjourned.
Can I get that close to that?